This week on Making Contact.
That can't be true. I said, this is the state of California, Gina. You will get medical. And she said, Mom, the girls are saying that there's girls in here dying.
The story of Gina Muniz, her life and her death as a prisoner of the California correctional system is, ultimately, the story of a family. But Gina's story is also a recounting of how a state-sanctioned life sentence became a state-sponsored death sentence, a story far too common in California prisons. This is the first of a three-part series, A Crisis of Care, a look inside the prison healthcare system in the state of California. In this first show, Gina's story, we'll hear from her family, the people she left behind, the family she was taken from. I'm Tina Rubio, and this is Making Contact, a program connecting people, vital ideas, and important information.
Let's put your shoes on. Where are you going? You're going outside with Grandpa in the back?
Yeah.
What are you guys doing back there?
We're chopping wood.
Ooh, for the fireplace tonight?
Uh-huh.
Good.
Hey, you need to fix my shoe.
Here.
Grace Ortega is taking care of her 7-year-old granddaughter, Angelina, at her home in Cala Mesa, California. It's a small and growing middle-class city, about an hour and a half east of Los Angeles.
There you go. Your mom probably made a little knot so they don't come untie, huh?
Yeah.
You jump a lot in school?
Yeah.
You jump around a lot?
Yeah, I do jump rope.
Grace, her husband David, their son little David, and their granddaughter Amanda live in a modest 3-bedroom home not far from the San Bernardino Mountains. The yard of the steel blue house is dotted with plum blossom trees, a maple tree, a small garden, and a blue and white statue of the Virgin Mary. Today, like most days, the house is full of life.
Okay.
What do you want on your
sandwich? I want turkey, lettuce, pickles, no tomato.
That's Grace's other granddaughter, Amanda. Warm, bright, and quick to smile, Amanda likes to joke and laugh a lot. She recently got a rhinestone piercing on the left side of her cheek.
When'd you get this?
For my birthday last year when I turned 15.
You did? Does it hurt?
They numb me, so it, has too much it didn't hurt at all.
That looks pretty.
Thank you.
Are you going to get others?
I don't know. I want my belly button, but I don't know. Actually, this is the way first.
At 16, she's a tall, striking young woman with long, dark hair and bright eyes, just like her mother, Gina.
When she walked in one time, when we moved here, she walked in and I just started crying, and she's, Grandma, what's wrong? And I said, Amanda, you look so much like your mother, and I'm so blessed to have you. And we both started crying.
Gina Muniz, Amanda's mom and Grace's only daughter, died from stage 2 cervical cancer at age 29. That was on November 29th, 2000. The cancer was treatable, but it wasn't treated, and not because Gina didn't want help, but because she was denied it. Gina Muniz was in prison, serving a life sentence for a nonviolent crime, a sentence most people agree she never should have received in the first place. Just days before her death, she received a compassionate release so she could die at home with loved ones around her. Gina's release into the arms of her family was the only form of compassion she would receive from the maze of lawyers, doctors, prison officials, and corrections officers who controlled her life and ultimately her death.
I have all the documents with me. I have every paper from that courtroom, what they put us through, because one day I said, my daughter's story will be told, the way she was treated, and taking her life from her, too.
As a society, we assume the responsibility for taking care of those we incarcerate, regardless of their crime. It's not just feel-good politics or the realized dream of basic social justice. It's in our Constitution, the 8th Amendment, to be exact, forbidding cruel and unusual punishment. Medical care, or the denial of it, falls under this provision. That means every time the state denies someone in prison appropriate health care, every time someone dies from medical neglect in prison, we the people are violating our own laws, the very same laws we judge others by when we hold them accountable for their crimes. Gina's story, her life and her death as a ward of the state, isn't unique. The courts have documented hundreds of incidents of medical neglect in California's prisons, from unsanitary conditions to incompetent doctors and nurses who misdiagnosed illnesses or didn't treat them. The state's failure to do anything to improve conditions prompted a federal judge in 2006 to strip the state of California of its management of medical care in the prison system. That same judge appointed a federal receiver to fix it. But that all came too late for Gina Muniz.
It doesn't take you a doctor to see how sick she was. She needed medical treatment right away. And they kept telling me, nope, she's fine. And we did a checkup on her and she's fine. And I said, no, you need to take my daughter out of there and you need to send her out to a hospital. If I have to pay for it, I'm willing to pay for it. I'll do anything. I said, just give me the bill and I'll give you the money now. I said, I'll meet you at the hospital. Please help my daughter, please.
It was a mother's plea for her daughter's life that never received an answer. I sit with Grace and her family in the living room by the fireplace. They each share stories, memories, and photographs of a daughter, a mom, and a sister they all love and miss.
Here's one. This was in Tacoma. It's Gina, Amanda, and me. This was our last Christmas together. Amanda's standing in the front of her mommy, and her mom's in the middle, and
smallest to biggest.
And then I'm behind Gina with my arms around her.
Look how pretty you guys all look.
I love my daughter a lot, and like I say, thank God, Gina, thank you that you left me a beautiful granddaughter too, to hug and love all over again. And this is Gina. This one, she was a cheerleader. We were at the park. And we're having a birthday party. I think it was Gina's birthday party. And her little friends. Gina was about 7 years old right here.
Did she like to cheerlead?
Oh, yeah, she did. Larry was a football player, and Gina was the cheerleader for Larry's team.
Oh, that's fun.
Yeah, they had a lot of fun.
And so she liked it? What got her into cheerleading?
Her brother. Gina, you need to come and cheer for me. And they're signing up the cheerleaders. So Gina went, and she liked it.
Grace is talking about Gina's brother, Larry. He's a deep shaft miner, currently on disability from a work-related injury. Larry was 27 when his sister died. He's now 35.
Yes, we were very close, actually. I was, of course, little brother and whatnot, and I'm proud to say that my first standing up as a male figure in the family was for my sister, and took care of business. 7 years old.
What happened?
I guess one of her school buddies threw a lemon at her back, liking her but not knowing how to express himself as an adolescent. Nailed her in the back with a lemon, and I turned around and jumped off my bike and did what little big brothers do.
Which was?
Take care of business. And he was 12 and I was 7, but I ended up getting the better half because I had, you know, that superhuman strength in me because it's my sister, so yeah.
You stood up for her honor.
Yeah, and he laid down for it. Yeah, so.
And I'm sure that you miss your sister. I'm sure she's on your mind.
Jesus, yeah, all the time. I mean, there's days that I just hear songs or whatever, you know, and she's there. She comes to my dreams.
What kind of songs?
It's mainly the Stones. Wild White Horses was one of her favorites, so.
It was?
Yeah, that one and the one with what's his name? Red Hot Chili Peppers, Under the Bridge.
Oh, uh-huh.
Yes.
That's a great song.
I love that song. It reminds me of her totally.
Uh-huh. Yeah. How would you describe her?
Always smiling. Not that she's not here no more, but she had a little bit of a glow to her. People liked it.
She was very independent. You know, she knew what she wanted in life.
That's David, Gina's stepfather. He's a lithographer by trade and co-owns a trucking business with Grace.
I think she was just not, you know, she was a tough person. I mean, mentally tough, but she was too kind-hearted. So people would get her that angle, you know what I mean? She, and she gave into it. So, you know, that's what caused her to get in trouble.
Photos from the family albums we are sharing show a naturally stunning young woman. At 5'11", with hazel eyes, a broad beaming smile, and long dark curls, she was a bright girl with a promising future. But like many teens often do, Gina drifted. She dropped out of high school during her sophomore year and dabbled with drugs. But by her mid-20s, she had a beautiful daughter, was studying for the GED, and was planning to attend nursing school. Then, a devastating experience changed everything. Coming up next.
She called me devastated and she said, Mom, I have a life sentence. You need to talk to this lawyer. What has he done to us?
You're listening to Making Contact, a production of the National Radio Project. If you'd like more information or for CD copies of this program, please call 800-529-5736. You can also download programs or get our podcast at radioproject.org. We now return to a crisis of care, Gina's story.
In 1998 of April, Gina's father, he got apprehended by the police. And we all knew that he had a drug problem.
Grace left Gina's and Larry's biological father when they were just toddlers. But throughout the years, Gina remained close to him.
Gina always felt sorry for him and said, Mom, one day my dad's going to die because he's doing drugs and he needs to change his life. So Gina was always worried about him. And one day Gina received a call from the grandmother on the father's side that her father had passed away. And Gina called me crying hysterical and saying, Mom, my dad has passed away. And I asked Gina what happened and she couldn't even talk. So I called the grandmother on Gina's father's side of the family, and she had said that he got apprehended by the police, and they had said that he had, while he was being handcuffed, that he went in cardiac arrest.
Well, he took a very serious beating by seven accused officers from Fresno, and I seen the scuff marks from the shine that wouldn't come out of their boot, a swat across his forehead that went down his cheek. Lined up perfectly with, it looked like a baton, something.
Were the police ever brought to some kind of justice? Were they reprimanded?
You know, it was ruled as a heart attack. But, you know, who's not going to have a heart attack when you got seven people beating on you, you know? That's the way I feel about it.
Grace says Gina's life began to spiral out of control. The death of her biological father triggered a debilitating bout of depression. And while Gina had used drugs before, by all accounts, she never used cocaine, at least until her cousin's much older husband offered the kind of support she didn't need, but in desperation, took.
He started telling Gina, you know, Gina, you should take something to calm you down. So my daughter had, she had done drugs before, but she had been off them for about going on 5 years. He started saying, Gina, why don't you go buy some cocaine and I'll buy it for you. And he would take her to the drug dealer's house and drive her over there and give her the money to buy the drugs. And he started telling her, here, tell them not to give you $40, to give you, here's $100. As my daughter got more addicted to the rock cocaine, she had no control of it no more. So now he started asking her for sex. And my daughter started giving him sex because this is the way he said, now you have to give me something back. What are you going to give me? And my daughter promised that she would pay him. And he said, no, I want something else. So he went and rented a motel behind the family's back. I never had an idea what was going on. And he rented my daughter a motel and he started having her there for days. As I call it, a drug raid is what I call it.
This ordeal went on for about a year. Gina was now in a full-blown addiction. Grace says over those agonizing months, Gina started spending more time away from her family, including her daughter Amanda.
She would come home and I'd say, Gina, where you been? It's 3 days. I was so afraid. And I would hug her and tell her, Gina, you need help. I started seeing the signs.
The skeletal body, the dark crescent moons underneath her eyes, the unpredictability. But the day came when Gina had finally had enough, and she gathered up the will to reject his advances.
He goes, because you don't want to have sex with me no more. So I can't buy you the drug no more, and I can't give you money. And she said, I'll pay you back. And my daughter said she was out of it. And he told her no, because you don't want to do favors for me no more. So Gina walked away from him, and she left.
But Gina needed money to feed her addiction. That wasn't something she could give up just yet. And in this state of mind, she walked toward a 51-year-old woman getting into her car outside of a bank parking lot. Gina pretended to have a gun.
Gina put her hand in her pocket and said, well, get in the car. And the lady did, and Gina took her to an ATM. And she had the lady draw $200 out.
Gina took the money and proceeded to drive the woman around LA County until the woman jumped out of the vehicle and reported the incident to the police. Gina abandoned the car, but was eventually turned in by her cousin, the same cousin whose husband had fostered Gina's addiction.
And so then, about a week later, she goes, Mom, she goes, I'm in jail. And I said, what? And she goes, I'm in jail. And she was crying. And she said, I'm just letting you know. She said, I didn't hurt no one, though. And I went to the police station, in Amani Police Station, and I asked for my daughter, and the detectives were talking to me, and they said that that Gina was in a lot of trouble, and that she had took this lady by force and took $200 from her, which was kidnapped, they were charging her with, and robbery. And I told her what happened here, Gina. And she was crying so much, and I was crying, that we didn't get much to say. She was more concerned about her daughter, Amanda, and she was concerned about me and herself now being in this mess.
Gina was sent to Los Angeles County's Twin Towers Jail, charged with kidnapping and robbery. While waiting for her sentencing hearing, she fell ill. Her stomach was extremely bloated, and she couldn't stop bleeding.
I told her, well, have you seen the doctor? And she said, yeah, I told them, and they told me that being my first time incarcerated and in trouble, that it's my nerves and I need to calm down. And I go, well, what did they give you? And me thinking, okay, it could be true. I'm not a doctor and my daughter's never been in trouble. So I know she was in a nervous wreck too. She was very sorry for what she did. And she went ahead and they told her to take vitamin B.
Gina's bleeding lasted for almost a month, but then suddenly stopped. During that time, Grace found a defense attorney to represent her daughter.
He told me that he would go ahead and take $5,000 cash to do a plea bargain, to ask the courts for a plea bargain. And then he said, but then if they want to take it to jury, then you have to give me $10,000 cash. So
10 more.
Yes. Five for a plea bargain. And if they went for the plea bargain and we were with a light sentence because of what happened, she was a victim herself, that then he was going to go ahead and do that, and maybe she get like 4 years, five. And it was a long time for us, 5 years. But I said, you know, I said, because what they said, the life sentence carried, and her being a victim herself, I figured, well, I figured the courts would understand once they hear her story, and this girl's never been in trouble before.
Except for one time, Gina had a brush with the law for driving without a license. She didn't do any jail time, but it did go on her record. So the family stayed hopeful until the day of Gina's hearing.
When we went to court, this lawyer, they were talking really fast in the courtroom, the judge and the lawyer. And I remember they kept saying a life sentence, life, life. I remember that. And I said, no, that can't be right. So then I seen the lawyer saying something to my daughter, but I couldn't hear what he was saying. So then they came out and they said that they needed to talk to the family, which it was my husband and all the family was there. He took us in a conference room, the lawyer did, and he said that they were offering Gina 7 years and we should take it. In good behavior, Gina will be out in five.
But 7 years seemed like a long time for someone who hadn't committed a violent crime.
I said, I need to talk to my daughter. So we went over there and the lawyer, Jack Ellis, he looked at me and he said, you better tell your daughter to sign this paper, because if she doesn't, you're never going to see her again. She'll get life. And I'm telling her to sign because it's 7 years. So Gina would say, no, 7 years is a long time, Mom. And it was for us to be separated. And I promised my daughter that I would be with her through this. I said, I'll be there every visit, Gina, like I have at Twin Towers. I haven't left you, have I? And she said, no. And I go, life is a long time, Gina. Just sign the paper, please.
Gina signed the papers, but things were about to get worse.
When I went to Twin Towers to visit my daughter, they said, your daughter's not here anymore. Where's my daughter? And they said, she's been transferred to a prison. Can I please find out what prison? And they said, no, because of security. We can't tell you. So I said, okay. And I went home and I carried my cell phone. I mean, my house phone, it's cordless. I carried it to the shower, just to find out where my daughter is. I didn't hear from her for almost a month and a half.
She was sent to the largest women's prison in the country, Central California Women's Facility in Chowchilla. It's located in the desert along California's Central Valley. Eventually, the call from Gina came, but it wasn't what Grace expected to hear.
She called me devastated and she said, Mom, I have a life sentence. You need to talk to this lawyer. What has he done to us? He lied to us. It's not seven, it's life plus seven. Well, then I was devastated. I said, and my daughter has signed the paper for me?
The family immediately hired another attorney. They filed an appeal and went back to court. A bailiff who was at the first sentencing hearing testified that Gina's lawyer had lied to her.
He said, I was behind Mrs. Muniz and her attorney, and I heard Gina's crying and asking him, is it life or is it seven? Because she was confused, very confused, he said. And the lawyer leaned over so nobody can hear. He said, but I heard. He whispered in her ear and say, it's seven, just say yes. And that's when Mrs. Muniz said yes. He said, but I knew it wasn't seven, the deputy said.
The charges of misrepresentation were proved. A judge ruled in Gina's favor and tossed out the first sentence. After 8 months at Chowchilla, Gina was transferred back to Twin Towers. Grace hoped her daughter would be offered the same 7-year sentence they thought she was getting before. But that wasn't going to happen. The district attorney's office wanted to go to trial. The family started over and began looking for a new attorney. Meanwhile, Gina's health got worse.
And I'm like, Gina, what's wrong? And you look so sad today. And she goes, Mom, I didn't want to worry you, but this menstruation doesn't stop. And she said, I have blood clots. And blood clots are coming out, and I'm begging them to please let me see the doctor. And they keep telling me to wait. So Gina started getting worse and worse. And now I'm like, okay, it's not normal. It's going on a month. And I started calling the doctors at Twin Towers and asking them, why isn't my daughter getting medical? Why are you denying her medical? And they told me, nothing's wrong with her. She's just nervous. We're giving her vitamin B, what we gave her the last time, and she's going to be fine. And they were giving my daughter Motrin for pain. And I said, why does my daughter have pain? And they said, well, it's just stress. And they wouldn't talk to me, but they would do this over in letters when I would leave messages on the phone, and then they would write me. And
that would just take forever. I mean, by the time you would call to complain and say what's going on, then it would be at least a week before you'd get another letter.
Right.
It took 6 months and a harrowing ordeal before Gina finally got the medical attention she needed.
One time my daughter was talking to me on the phone and she goes, Mom, I feel like I'm fainting. I feel like I'm dying. And I just heard the phone hit the wall. And I heard her fall. This is at Twin Towers. This is 6 months later, 7 months later, of trying to get her medical. And I remember yelling and I thought my daughter died. She bled to death.
Gina didn't die. She was rushed to a correctional medical treatment center. That's where she finally found out just how sick she was.
She said, Mom, she said, I have something to tell you. She said, why I'm sick. And she goes, I just got back from the doctor after all the testing and all the months that passed. And everything. I said, oh, they found out what's wrong with you. And she said, yes. And I thought it was going to be an infection or something. And they said, no, that my daughter had cervical cancer. They found cancer on her, 2B. I said, what's 2B, Gina? Is it curable? And I remember just crying and crying. And she said, Mom, don't cry. She said, I'm going to be okay. It's treatable. it's in an early stage still to be. She said, the only thing that I'm not going to be able to have is any more children, but I could always adopt, Mom. And I said, you're right, Gina. She was supporting me with my... And I told her, yes, you're right. And I got a hold of myself, and she said she was going to get chemo and radiation for 6 weeks. And they were going to shrink the tumor, and then they were going to give her a hysterectomy.
But doctors never performed the hysterectomy. Prison officials delayed and delayed Gina's treatment until her time ran out. The California Department of Corrections and Rehabilitation conducted a study in 2006. It showed, out of 426 health-related deaths, 15% were either preventable or possibly preventable. That's 64 people, 64 sons and daughters, mothers and fathers, sisters and brothers, who might have lived if they received treatment. Some prison rights groups put the numbers much higher. But hard facts are difficult to come by. Correction officers say medical records are often non-existent, unreadable, or incomplete. But why? They are responsible for the welfare of people whose lives we have, by law, placed under state control. People who too often are neglected at a time when they need attention and medical care. People like Gina. Next week on A Crisis of Care.
This person doesn't need to be thrown away for 25 years. Stick her in a program, a tough one. But they didn't do it. They got rid of her. They just threw her, like, discarded trash.
And then we started fighting for a compassionate release for Gina. And Donna had warned me. She had said, Grace, she said, I want to warn you. She said, I understand Gina's sick and she doesn't have much to live. But I need to tell you, I know it's going to be painful, but there's a possibility they'll deny Gina to come home.
When you're asking for parole or compassionate release, these hearings are very cold hearings. I mean, you're looking at, I don't know, 6 or 7 people on that board and motionless. I don't think if you were to sacrifice somebody in front of them, they wouldn't even blink.
Gina received both chemotherapy and radiation treatments at Twin Towers while awaiting trial, a trial that would eventually send her back to Chowchilla, the epicenter of California's prison healthcare crisis, and the place that would ultimately take her life. Please join us next week for part 2 of A Crisis of Care. Many thanks to all the people who contributed their time, energy, and support to this show, especially to freelance audio producer Mike Lamar, to Matt Fidler of Fidler Sound and Media, who wrote and produced the music for this show, and to Steve Macer and Julie Small Babbage. Much appreciation to the Omnia Foundation, who helped make this show possible, and to Dan Turner, Ron Rucker, and the Monday Morning Breakfast crew. For a CD copy of program number 1308, please call 800-529-5736, or you can get our podcast at radioproject.org. Lisa Redman is our executive director, Andrew Stelzer, producer, Puck Lowe, associate producer, Elena Bakken-Levy and Samson Rainey, interns, and I'm Tina Rubio. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.